Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And today we have another great author chat for you. This time we're talking with Judy I. Lin, the author of The Book of Tea Duology, A Magic Steeped in Poison, and the recently released A Venom Dark and Sweet. They are a series of Asian-inspired YA fantasy surrounding a magic that's based around the art of tea and features all sorts of palace intrigue, wuxia, and xinxia action. And man, I had a lot of fun reading this book. I'm super excited that we got to speak with Judy. This has been a book that's been on our list for a while now because it made quite a splash when the first book came out late last year.
Yeah, I knew that this was Marvin's jam ever since I read the premise, because it's a competition story, the first book is, because you have all of these tea makers traveling to the Imperial City to compete, and the winner will receive a favor from the royal. And I was like, Marvin loves Top Chef so much. So I feel, and he loves genre, Asian fantasies. I'm like, this is his book.
It checks a lot of my boxes. It has Asian inspired fantasy. It's fantasy in general, which I love. It has magical tea. And we all know I love a good milk tea. And, you know, the first book surrounds a magical tea tournament, which, you know, the tournament arcs are always the best arcs in any series or anime, right?
Yeah, I love seeing puzzles and challenges. I love escape rooms. So I just love it when books have riddles and challenges for the protagonist to compete. And the second book came out so quickly after the first book release. So we were able to read it back to back. And I was just so grateful that I already had the second book.
That first book ends in a gnarly cliffhanger. So
yeah, that cliffhanger is just, I feel so bad for those of you who had to actually wait for the second book to come out. But I had a lot of fun reading it. The second book expands more on the world of Dashi, and we see gods, we have different perspectives, and it was just so much fun to read. It was very immersive, and I'm excited to share our chat with Judy.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun talking to her about her inspirations, how she came up with her magical tea system, her research, and it was just a really fun chat. So yeah, let's get right to it. Please enjoy our author chat with Judy I. Lin. And we are here with Judy I. Lin, the author of A Magic Steeped in Poison and A Venom Dark and Sweet. Welcome to the show, Judy.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah. Congratulations on finishing your first series, I guess, your first series of books. How do you feel?
Tired, but really happy. Yeah, really happy that it's out in the hands of readers. And it feels like it's been long time coming, but then everything happened really fast after the first book launched.
Congratulations on reaching the New York Times bestsellers list again, because your first book reached number one, I think, and then this book reached number three.
Yes, I think that was it was pretty exciting, pretty surprising, but just so thrilled that yeah, people are very receptive to the books. Just because it was so specific, I felt like I've always been told that the books are very niche. So it's happy to see that it's reaching a wide audience.
I think, yeah, we can probably talk more about that because that's always been the case for especially like Asian-inspired fantasy. It's like everyone says it's niche because it's such a, it's based on stories that the mainstream aren't familiar with. But honestly, like, it's not like we haven't seen a story about adventures and a grand tournament before. I don't know. It's always frustrating to hear people like call this type of story niche when it's really not. It's like these themes are universal. Like these adventure and fantasy themes are books that we grew up reading. And
yeah, I definitely agree. Cause I mean, I try to write blending all the things that I love. Like that's why you see the competition, and you see the different types of like magic that's involved because I grew up reading a lot of, fantasy stories that have these elements, but then I wanted to incorporate some of the things. Yeah, like you said, I grew up with too, all the myths and legends that are very, very familiar to me as well. Like it's not even two sides of me. It's like all combined into one. So to incorporating it felt very natural to me. That's why it's very surprising that when people say, oh, it's might be difficult to reach an audience with this type of story when, there's Asian people can enjoy it, but there's no reason why other people can't enjoy it either.
If I need to read another tale inspired by the War of the Roses, they can read another story inspired by court drama and wuxia. It's like, it's got to go both ways, right? But yes. Speaking of, being on a bestsellers list, something that, again, it's a very basic Asian American question, but we are an Asian American, Asian diaspora podcast. We always want to know, were your parents supportive? Were they skeptical? And did that turn around once you got listed as a bestseller?
Yeah. Well, my parents are very traditional Taiwanese parents. So when I was writing in junior high and high school, that was always seen as a hobby, right? You would do that on the side, but that can't be what your main profession is. They always encouraged me to go to a profession that pays better. And back then too, as a teen, there weren't that many Asian American authors. Like certainly weren't many that were hitting like the bestseller list or even very prominent on the shelves. So to them, because they are not able to see those examples, that this doesn't seem to be a profession worth pursuing, unfortunately. And so that's why I actually went into cell biology, and then I went into healthcare. But I always kept, I still went into creative writing classes. I wrote a lot of poetry. And then it wasn't until after I graduated from university with my master's in occupational therapy and I started working in healthcare that I had time then in the evenings to go back to writing and then just rediscover my love for it again. So that's where kind of led to the two books coming out now. And my parents' reception, they don't read a lot of young adult fantasy. So to them, they're like, we'll wait. Hopefully you'll get a Chinese translation. That's what they're waiting for.
It's like you give them a copy of your book and they're like, okay, we're going to put this on our bookshelf. And, yes. It's there for display, but they're not going to crack it open.
Have you been picked up by like the World News or like the Chinese papers yet? I think that's when parents really like notice when like they get sent articles by their friends, like, is this your daughter on the Suji Lubao or whatever?
Yeah, no, unfortunately. Yeah, I definitely knew those like Chinese newspapers you find in Chinatown. I think that would definitely make them more receptive to the book. But I mean, they're very supportive. They're like very, very happy for me. And then of course they share it with all their friends, like, oh, this, look at what my daughter did. But that's not their interest and they don't pay attention to it. So, my sister really is my biggest fan and she's very supportive. So in terms of like family support, like my sister is my number one. She goes to the bookstore and like takes photos of my books and buys a bunch of copies for her friends. So
well. I love it. I love it. So I did some digging, and please don't freak out, but I found out that you're a gamer, that you yes. used to play Dragon Age and Mass Effect, and that helped you go into fan fiction writing and practice your craft. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so that was when I was like first starting out in my professional career, and then I got really into video games at that time, just because it's like a way to decompress after working all day. And I just love this type of storytelling in those games. That's the type of video games that I enjoy the most. It's just when they have like really interesting relationships and character choices, and then it kind of develops your character that way and affects the storyline. So those are the types of games that I love. And because of the way that Dragon Age Origins is written, it's just you have so many original characters that you can follow along with the storyline. So that's where I found it really freeing to write in that world, just because you have an established world, but then you have the freedom to develop the characters that are presented in there. And of course, with the multiple storylines, you can kind of go off and make the story your own as well. And that was a lot of fun for me, just because it kind of opened up a new world that I can write in, and also work together with other people in the fandom. And because, I mean, fandom people are great. They always like comment on your posts. They love those ships. And then that's really, really that was really encouraging to me as a getting back into writing, just because you get that instant gratification, right, of the likes and the comments. And so that really worked on developing my craft in those early days of writing.
Yeah. In my opinion, still the best Dragon Age of the three.
Dragon Age Origins.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like when we think about like fantasy worlds and writing, like we usually think of like what, like Lord of the Rings and like Game of Thrones. But, you know, like we said earlier, it's not like people can't understand court dramas and like Asian myths. So I have to ask, like, do you have any sea dramas that helped you go into the world of the Book of Tea? Any inspirations from there?
I feel like I say this a lot, but I mean, Nirvana and Fire is still my number one classic. Top sea drama of all times. Even like so many years later, I still watch it like once a year. And then sometimes when I want to go into those moments, I would play like the YouTube clips of the scenes, just because the storyline was so interesting. Like the relationships in the drama are really meaningful. And of course I love the politics and the intrigue and how the twists and turns of the story kind of played out. So I just think it's still one of the best dramas out there for me. And then in terms of focusing on the tea, actually I watched the story of Ming Lan during that time as well when I was writing, because there is a focus on tea brewing and some of the ceremonies in the story. But it's very, very family-focused story. So that I was also really interested and inspired by. So those are the two dramas I would say that were the most influential when I was writing the duology.
Yeah. Speaking of tea, how hands-on were you in your research of like the different teas? Because, you know, when most people think of tea, they think of like, you know, your jasmines or like your the tea you have at tea time. But then for Chinese people, I can only speak for Chinese people. Many things can be tea. Flowers can be tea, any type of leaves. And, you know, especially the tea leaves. Like, I had a friend who got really into tea making. And so she was explaining to me, like, how, like, all the different types of tea are all the same leaf. It's just prepared in different ways. And that is to say, I know that the world of tea is vast and deep. So, like, how deep did you go into your research?
To be honest, like when I grew up drinking tea, I just like it was just something that you do every day, right? Like I didn't really think about it that much. And it's just like I would visit my parents and then my dad would be like, here's some oolong tea, and he would brew it. But it was really when I was researching and developing this story that I started becoming diving into the type of ceremony and the type of tea leaves. And it's just opens up this very, very like interesting world of like competition teas and like people who would buy these very, very expensive teas and they would argue about like what's the best type of teapot to brew it in. And then they would all have, every region has like their very specific preferences. So, I mean, that is all so fascinating to me. And I wish like there were so many details I wish I could include in the story, but I just didn't have enough space to explore that further. But I did travel back to Taiwan to do the research and go and visit a tea farm. Mm-hmm. And that was so much fun to actually see how it's being produced. I mean, now it's every day. It's like most of it is all machine prepared, all the roasting and preparing. But just to be able to see it and like to walk through the tea trees on the farm and to like sit down and then taste the different preparations of what I just saw them pick and then also to see how they add the different flowers to the teas and how depending on the type of flower it would they would do different types of preparations of how it's incorporated. So all of that was just so much fun and I think helped me really immerse myself in the experience and understand how the living on a tea farm would feel like for Ning in the story.
Yeah. People who love tea really love tea.
I mean, it's the same thing with fandom, Marvin. People who are really into things are really into things. And there's always a community to help foster that passion.
Yeah, I would buy the behind-the-scenes Judy Island Journey into Tea supplement to the Book of
like
Tea.
Like a cookbook, like a catalog.
Or like just a travel log, like a travel vlog maybe.
Yeah, start a YouTube channel and like do like ASMR tea like making. but we got a little bit ahead of ourselves. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey to publication? Because I remember when we announced your book deal, Magic Steeped in Poison, that wasn't the original title. It was Heart of Severed Leaves, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that feels like so long ago.
I know, but, it's publishing. Time moves differently.
Yeah, so I actually started seriously pursuing publication back in end of 2015. So it was like even longer before that. Because I wrote my first manuscript. It was actually a young adult horror set in Taiwan. Wow. And I entered it into Pitch Wars, which is a mentorship program that was around on Twitter back then. And that was through the revising with my mentors. That was how I got my agent. But unfortunately, that manuscript didn't sell. So then it was just the couple years later, I just kept working on different ideas. I auditioned for a couple of things. But then I started working on what would become the Book of Tea project. And it was, I went through a couple of rounds of revision with my agent and with some early readers. And, but it still took a little while because back then, I think the fantasy genre, people were saying it was getting so saturated. And, but of course you hear that, but that was when like a lot of authors of color were getting their fantasy stories, like finally, being recognized and becoming more popular. So I mean, it's really disheartening as like an Asian author to hear that. But I mean, we ended up selling the project, and of course, it with a lot of other Asian fantasies doing really well in the market now. So it's just really great to see that being proven wrong. And here we are today.
Yeah. Did you always plan it to be a duology? I remember us hearing a lot of buzz about the first book, Magic, Steep, and Poison, when it came out. You know, got listed on bestsellers list. Everyone was talking about, we're like, oh, we should read that at some point. And then all of a sudden there's a sequel. Like, we got like half a year later.
Yeah, the turnaround time was very tight. I was like, yes. Whoa, she wrote that book real fast.
Yes. So when we originally sold it, yeah, it was on a more traditional publishing timeline. So it would be like this, the first book would come out and then the second book would come out a year later. But my editor and my imprint wanted to try something a little bit different in releasing the two books closer together, just because then readers can pick it up quicker. They can buy the two books together so they don't have to wait finish off the duology. So I ended up writing, because the first book sold on proposal, so I only had the first few chapters written. So I was given more time at that time anyway to finish out the first book. So then the second book timeline kind of got more crunched in following that. So I was revising the first book while I was drafting the second book. And it was not going to lie, very stressful during that time. But I think it ended up being better for the story, because I could still go back to the first book and make some of those little revisions of things, details that I included in the second book. So overall, I think it actually improved the flow of the story, and then and I ended up being able to tell the story in a more cohesive way, and as was my original goal.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who was not very patient, I appreciate the quick turnaround, because then I can, you know, I didn't have to wait a year or two to find out what happens to all these characters. So thank you. I hope the experiment went well, because I guess it was stressful for you, but it was definitely gratifying for me.
Instant gratification.
Yes.
So in the Book of Tea, you have this magical tea system. You have the Shenang Tu, who are able to, I guess, like when we think of East Asian inspired fantasies, we see like Wuxia and Shangsha, right? Mm-hmm. Like military combat, like that's what comes to mind. But with the Shenang Tu, it's tea. Like their weapon is drinking tea and kind of shifting into dreamscapes and whatnot. And I thought that was a very unique type of magic. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with that magical system?
Because when I first started working on the project, I knew tea magic was going to be at the center of the story. So that was what I needed to develop first before I got into anything else with the plot or the characters. So in working with that, I knew that it wasn't going to be a combat-based magic system. Because what are you going to do, like throw the tea into somebody's face? They have to drink it, and then you have to have the time to prepare it and to utilize the magic on them or affect the whoever you're trying to affect. So that was why I needed to really consider what that type of magic would look like. Like it already has certain limitations from the start in terms of accessing the ingredients and then being able to have access to water. So that was really fun to come up with the different types of magic that's present and showcased throughout the first book in the competition rounds. So that was my focus, and that's why I chose the competition, so that I can feature these different preparations of tea in the story, and also that ups the intensity, because if you're just going to have a book about brewing and tea, that's very relaxing, but there wouldn't be very much plot to kind of forward the story. So that's why the competition aspect was very important to me to be able to demonstrate this. And then I think in the second book, I wanted to take that even further, because in a competition round, you're in the beautiful palace, you have access to the vessels, the hot water, and probably all the very high-end ingredients. But in second book, when we are journeying through the empire, Ning doesn't have access to any of that. So what would those type of brews look like? So then that was more fun to play around with how tea brewing would take on different dimensions in the sequel as well. But of course, when I was writing, I couldn't resist adding in some of the martial arts elements. So that's why you'll see some of those very common wuxia tropes, like running across the rooftops and like assassins coming in at nighttime. And so, and like being ambushed in the back alley, like all those things are very common in wuxia. So I had to write that into the story.
In the second book, you go outside of the palace and you see more of the world of Dashi in the sequel. And I just want to ask, like, where did you base any of the fictional towns and regions on real places? Like, what was it like unfurling the map of Dashi?
So I think Taiwanese people will recognize some of the locations, because I've already had people who lived in Taiwan or are from Taiwan who already messaged me saying, like, this sounds familiar. Where did you draw it from? So definitely for naming anyway, I did draw upon some of the names for the places, mostly from Taiwan, because that was just a lot of fun to include those little bits. And also from a lot of wuxia stories too. Some of the names are kind of plays on different, like, famous wuxia locations that are common in those stories. So it was a bit from drawing from literature and a drawing from my own background of neighborhoods and the towns that I grew up in.
A Magic Steep in Poison, it's written in Ning's POV, but the second book, Venom Dark and Sweet, it's written in two POVs. You have Ning's and you have Kang's. And how was it just writing in a different POV? And also, you write in third person for Kang's POV. So you're switching from first person to third person. So how was changing your writing style into that?
I really enjoyed it because at first, the first draft of the sequel, it was only Ning's POV, but it just felt like something was missing. So then my editor was like, well, why don't you put in Kang's POV? Because there's a lot of the story that we're not able to see when it's just from Ning's POV. And that made a lot of sense to me. But I was playing around with writing Kang's perspective. It just felt like I wanted it to be distinguished from Ning's perspective, for one, and also for a lot of the second book. Like, he's very confused and probably a little terrified of all the things that are happening around him that he doesn't understand. So I wanted to make sure that the reader experienced that as well. So to putting a little bit more of a distance between him and the rest of the court around him. So that's why I felt like the third person perspective was the most effective in getting that across. So it was very intentional in how I wrote it. And I know for some readers that transition is a little bit jarring, but I did want that. It was a purposeful decision as an author to have that sort of separation. And I think the first person POV too, maintaining that for Ning's, is really important because ultimately it is still her story. So it's still her journey in the end that we're following. Having Kang's perspective just adds a little bit of background information and insight of the other going-ons in the empire that Ning wouldn't have access to.
Yeah, I mean, the scope of the sequel is so much grander than the first book, where the first book mainly took place in the palace during a tournament, and the second book takes place across the entire empire. And the scope of the conflict extends past politics to, like, myths. And were these aspects, were these, story building aspects, were they already, did you already have like an idea of like what your world was, or did you have to build it for the second book as well?
I had an idea of what I wanted it to look like, because it is modeled after my inspiration was always the Song Dynasty of Imperial China, but I also didn't want it to be an exact replica. So there's some historical sites and locations that might seem a little bit familiar, but it definitely was not meant to be an exact replica, because I kind of put in a couple of the different details of that I wanted to include, just because, once again, returning to like the Wuxia inspirations, I wanted to have like some scenes that occur in certain like monasteries, and in some scenes in like of the bamboo forest. So those are some of the details that I wanted to add to the story. So then just figuring out what would make sense to in terms of the travel and the timeline, because those are all the things I just never thought about before writing it, that a fantasy author has to figure out, like, how long would it actually take to travel on horseback from between this distance, or between these places if there are these geographical features. So that actually took a lot of time to figure out, and which is why I really wanted a map in the second book, but I didn't get my map. So that's why I commissioned a map, so that I could give that out to my readers for my pre-order campaign.
I actually flipped to the beginning of the book to see if there was a map, and I was like, oh, where's the map?
I know. I thought maps are always really important in fantasy books, I feel. But for the second book, I just felt it was like so necessary to kind of understand the layout of Daxi, but sadly it did not come to be. So Now you can look at the map. I should put it on my website. That's a good reminder. I should put the map on my website.
One of the relationships I really liked that you expand on in the second book is Princess Zhen and her bodyguard Rui's sapphic relationship. Mm-hmm. In the first book, you kind of get like a glimpse of it, but in the second book, it's very, very much like expanded. You kind of see the love that they share is very sweet, and the loyalty that they have for each other is very, very it's very romantic. It was really nice to see how normalized that relationship is, because when we think of like East Asian inspired fantasies and court dramas, there is a lot of like misogyny and and a lot of like homophobic like underlying commentary. And you know, like, of course, the female characters in your book, they do face like sexism, but I feel like most of the inequality comes from like economic and regional biases. So can you talk about like how you decided to include Zhen and Rui's sapphic relationship into the book, and how did it add to the story?
So I knew that one thing I wanted to write was, because in a traditional fantasy, the commoner going to the palace and like falling in love with the prince is like such a common trope in a fantasy or even a fairy tale story. So I wanted to kind of play on that. So I wanted and I mean, in the court dramas that I watched once, like, it's always about like these various princes fighting each other, but the princesses are just married off, right? They're just like married off to a different kingdom for alliances. But I wanted to a story where the princess isn't married off, that she is the heir, but there's other reasons why that would affect her ascendancy to the throne. So I really want to have that aspect, but I'm really, really a sucker for the like the bodyguard type of trope. I just love romance between like the bodyguard and the person they're supposed to protect. And so it just felt really natural to write Rui as the handmaiden / bodyguard to the princess, who's been very loyal and at her side, but also to incorporate that kind of romantic trope. And and I thought it would be interesting too, where Ning, like, in what you would expect is for her to fall in love with the prince, but then there is this princess, and the princess is actually in love with somebody else. So that's not a route that she's able to go down. And I also wanted to portray it like a very strong queer relationship that's not not in question. Like, it's not, there's like no other interferences. Like, and I don't think that's my type of story to write either, because I'm not in a queer relationship. So I wanted to just portray one that's very positive and one that is, once again, not in question. And also one that is, I was inspired by The Old Guard, the movie, where it's like these, I guess you would call them immortals, that just love each other, and the power of their love is, and their relationship is very strong throughout time. So that was kind of my inspiration when it came to that, with them, their pairing. And I guess the final thing I wanted to say too is that queer relationships have been in like historical China. Like that's not in question. It's just certain time periods and certain philosophies have changed that, but it was once accepted. So, I mean, it is historically accurate as well to include these types of relationships in the story.
Yeah, and you know, they weren't the only queer relationship. Your book is full of queer relationships, and it was really cool to see it being normalized in this world and something that no one really calls out. Something else that, you know, I noticed as like a Taiwanese Chinese person is that the language that your fantasy world uses is Mandarin Chinese, and you do use, you know, those forward idioms, and like you do have actual like Chinese wording in your book as well. I mean, can you tell us about the decision to use Chinese as like the language of your world?
That was like days upon days of agonizing over like, what should I include? Should I include the characters? Should I include the tone marks? Should I be translating the idioms or some of the references, or should I like write them out and in Chinese characters? So that was, I wanted to make sure that the book is accessible, but I also wanted to make sure that I pay tribute to the influences and put them in kind of as, I guess there would be Easter eggs for people who are familiar with those legends and those idioms would be able to see and refer to, but also once again, with a twist and not an exact replica, because that's not what my attention is. Like, once again, I didn't want to replicate like Imperial China. that was not my goal. So I just wanted it to look and sound and feel like a wuxia or xianxia story, where you can see these familiar things to people who are who grew up in the culture, but then to change it a little bit. And so that's why I really wanted to make sure that everything that I mentioned in the, that I had reference to in Pinyin, was actually I tried to include the Chinese characters in the glossary as well, because that was really important to me. Just because, like, in Taiwan, we don't learn Pinyin. We learn from like Bopomofo. So I had the Chinese characters first, and then I had to actually translate it into Pinyin to include it into the story. So I put in a lot of effort in finding the idioms and naming the places and the characters. So I wanted to share that too with people, who readers who are interested in that as well. So that was a lot of decision making as to why I would make the choices of whether it's Pinyin, whether it's the characters, and whether it's the translations.
Your main character Ning is just so strong, and so like I like that she is always proactive, even though she's like brutal with guilt and self doubt. I loved seeing her journey as she, you know, becomes confident in herself throughout the first book, and then goes on her grand journey in the second.
Yeah, the first book is like her being like, oh my gosh, I'm an imposter, and kind of having this imposter syndrome. And the second book is like her actually coming to terms with her power, being like, okay, I'm actually really good at this. So it was really nice to see that arc definitely in the second book.
Yeah, I guess, can you tell us a little bit about just how you came up with that character? Like, what inspired the main character of your book?
So I wanted to write a story where Ning is feeling very guilty because of what happened to her. Like, I mean, this isn't a spoiler because it happens in the first chapter, like accidentally poisoning her mother. And then that kind of sets her on this journeyed in order to atone for that by saving her sister. So that was the idea of family is always a very strong driving force in the stories that I write. And I think that's just, I mean, in my opinion, part of like the Taiwanese culture being raised in that sort of household where those stories are always present. But of course, there's always that, maybe this is more of a diaspora conflict in that you are trying to respect your parents, but also find your own way. So that kind of journey is present in her travels as well. And just in terms of leaving home in order to discover who you are, but in the process of leaving home, learning more about your family and learning more about where you came from and appreciating that. And also seeing your parents as different, like that they have their own story and their own journeys that happened before you were even born. So that was kind of what I wanted to explore as I was writing Ning's story. And in the first book anyway, and yes, and then the second book is really about her coming into herself and then being able to embrace what she had once rejected and then being able to take on that it's no longer about herself and her family and that it is a more of a responsibility and weight of the effects of the poison across the entirety of Daxi. So so in a sense it is like the story is these two pieces and that's why I chose very purposefully of where I ended the first book, even though some people were very upset at me about the cliffhanger. But I think that was a very pivotal moment in how the story shifts in terms of Ning's journey.
Yeah. I mean, the stakes are already pretty high in the first book and get so much higher in the second
one. Like, I definitely got the diaspora feels from Kang's point of view as well, because he has like this huge expectation from his father and he really idolizes his father too, but he is coming to terms with like, okay, maybe like my father is like not as perfect and golden as I thought he was, and learning how to make like his own decisions and dealing with the consequences of his own decisions. I was like, okay, I see the diaspora pressure and just, you know, like wanting to please your parents, but at the same time trying to walk your own path. So I kind of saw that parallel with Ning and Kang's story.
Yeah, because they are similar in that they can truly relate to each other because of all these different pressures, and then just in terms of how they deal with that, it is different in how they come together and then apart in the story. So that was really interesting to play with, especially because I wouldn't have been able to do that in the first book without the dual POV. So that was definitely a way to get insight into why Kang made the decisions he did in the first book and then the after effects of that.
Yeah, I just want these kids to be happy.
yeah. Oh God, the pining is real. but we're winding down to the end of our interview, and I think we would be remiss to like not mention the gorgeous covers of your books, because they're definitely eye-catching. So can you tell us a little bit about, like, I don't know, did you have any input into your covers? I know that's rare for authors. Like, what was your reaction when you saw the cover designs?
So the illustrator is Cija Hong, and she is amazing. I did have I sent my editor some information about like the different elements that were present in the book, like the flowers and then the fish and of course I did send some reference materials to what the tea set would look like, but it was really the designer Rich Diaz and then Sija coming together and creating these beautiful pieces of art, really, like, in my opinion, just because they're so gorgeous. And then when I received the full, because it's actually a whole scroll. Like, if you pull out the covers for the first book and pull out the covers for the second book, it actually all connects together into a full a piece of art. So that when I saw that, it was like so amazing. So you can, yeah, you can actually line them up and you can,
I'm like,
you can see where the pieces line up. So that was like truly mind blowing. Like it was really amazing to see just how much thought they had put into putting the covers together. And of course, the colors and what they chose in terms of how the two covers like contrast with one another, but still have the common themes. So it was, I mean, I'm not an artist, so this is your domain, and it was like way beyond my expectations, to be honest.
I have to say, right, yeah, like when I go to bookstores, like see your book like churned out on the shelf, because it is, the cover is so pretty. And really, like, we shouldn't judge books by their covers, but we definitely do, and they help with sales. Yes. So I've definitely seen a couple people pick up your book at like Barnes & Noble and local bookstores because the cover looks pretty. So I hope they enjoy the story too, because, you know, don't just buy a book because the cover is pretty. But also, you know, if the cover is
pretty. Well, lucky them, the story's great too. So yeah. Win-win.
Win-win.
Yes. Again, congratulations on completing your duology, on the launch of your second book as well. I guess, you know, are you sitting back? I know you're doing press and doing all the marketing obligations for your book, but are you working on anything else? Are you taking a break, or are you like back on the grind?
So I have another book in the works. Actually, I'm actually on deadline for it, so it's very stressful. But it is another young adult fantasy, but it's not like a continuation of the Book of Tea. It's not set in the same world. It's more actually xianxia world inspired. So a lot of like the celestials and that type of more natural magic. But it's definitely still very, very immersed in like Chinese and Taiwanese mythology. Still lots of, yeah, cultural references, lots of, it'll probably include more Chinese characters and those idioms and those, the different types of wordplay on that, because that's just what I have fun with when I'm writing. So hopefully I'll get to announce more details about it soon, and excited to share that with readers.
Yeah, excited to see where you go, excited to see, you know, what inspirations you draw from and what, you know, aspects of Chinese culture you subvert. I think it's all very exciting.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, this was a lot of fun.
And that was Judy Ireland, the author of The Book of Tea Duology, A Magic Steeped in Poison, and A Venom Dark and Sweet. Both books available now at booksellers everywhere, including the Books and Boba online bookstore. As always, if you do purchase books from our online bookstore, you do not only do you support your local bookstores, but you also support us at the Books and Boba podcast. So we really appreciate everyone who's been purchasing books from there. You can check out the bookstore by going to booksandboba.com and clicking on the bookstore link. But yeah, I'm excited that Judy's writing another book. Can't wait to learn more about that. But as we wait, Rira, please remind us what we're reading for the month of September.
So our September book is You're Invited by Amanda Jayatissa, and it's about a Sri Lankan woman who travels to Sri Lanka to stop her former best friend and her ex-boyfriend from marrying, and there is a disappearance, and there is a supposed murder that she gets accused of. So, fun times. I love murder. I love weddings. This is my jam. I'm very excited to read it.
Yeah, you told me it's been pitched as Crazy Rich Asians meets Gone Girl, which sounds terrifying. But
I love it. I love the pitch, so I'm very excited to read it. And I think it's a really good book that transitions into spooky month, you know?
Yeah. It is spooky month coming up. Yeah. All right. We'll be discussing You're Invited at the end of the month. So if you're reading along or if you have finished the book, please let us know your thoughts on our Goodreads forums. We always love to include feedback from our listeners in our discussion whenever possible. But that'll do it for this episode of Books M Boba. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Judy Eilin for joining us on our podcast. And we will see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books M Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Ri Ryu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @BooksMBoba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books M Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books M Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Host the podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone, especially for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.